From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the third segment in a series of discussions about notions of tragedy in Western literature. How do conceptions of the tragic in Western drama and literature broadly connect to personal issues, such as the family and religion, and to wide cultural issues, such as social classes, institutions, and beliefs? The panelists are Peter Smith, Robert Terhorst, Peter Burian, and Eugene Falk. Peter Smith is a professor of classics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robert Terhorst teaches Spanish language and literature at the University of Arizona and is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book about the novel as a literary form and its relationship to money. Peter Burian is a professor of classics at Duke University. Eugene Falk teaches comparative literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Here is Peter Smith.
In the earliest tragedy that survives to us, Aeschylus' Persians, it's the only historical play that survives to us from 5th century Athens. Aeschylus has imposed a kind of family relation on the continents of Europe and Asia. The invasion, the Persian invasion of Greece under Xerxes, is presented in the imagery of the play as a conflict between siblings, almost, between Asia and Europe, who should be equals, but in this case one is trying to subdue the other. And Xerxes' mother even has a dream in which Greece and Asia are personified as sisters. It seems almost as though the tragedian tends to cast the conflict which he's concerned with, and in that case it was a historical one, to cast it in the language of internal family strife between opponents of a sort. And I suppose the opponents with whom we strive most intimately and longest in our lives, and in ways that are sometimes hidden from ourselves, are our family members.
It isn't surprising then that tragedy would have religious social connections in all of its manifestations. If you're talking about relationships between parents and children, how have some of our examples, some of our writers here, how have they looked at religion? For instance, one scholar, Kenneth Muir, has pointed out that a play like King Lear could not have been set in an age of reason or of Christianity. Why is that so?
I don't think it is true. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, even though it's ostensible, Lear's ostensible setting is pre-Christian, the actual time of its composition is Christian. One way that dramatists get around the problem of different religious dispensations is to have the older faith revive, the older faith come back. And speaking of sibling rivalry, of course, the relationship between ancient culture and Christian culture is one of sibling rivalry. The two expressions of religion have an oddly symbiotic relationship, so that you find in Calderón's mythological plays, for example, that the Christian can be diminished at the expense of the pagan. The pagan can revive, come back, flourish again. So I don't really see that the Christian inhibits or expels the tragic. But I do think that tragedy relates to its Christian religious dispensation differently from the way it did in classical antiquity, which was perhaps more hospitable to it.
I think it might be possible to align the problem of Christian tragedy and the problem of bourgeois tragedy to an extent, mm-hmm. perhaps in the following way, very roughly. Christianity presumably offers a saving dispensation to mankind, so that a Lear who rails really against the very conditions of human existence entirely, in a Christian context, would in some way be heretical, blasphemous, a rejecter of the salvation which God in his providence offers. The bourgeois world has institutions which provide ways out of dilemmas that might otherwise lead to the starkest sorts of results, to tragic consequences. I mean, why didn't the Montagues and the Capulets go into family therapy? Well, once you allow that possibility, there's some way in which you destroy the possibility of tragedy in most of the traditional senses of the word. Just as there's a sense in which Christianity viewed head on offers a solution to tragic dilemmas, and therefore in a certain way short circuits the possibility of tragedy. Then, in a way, a whole realm of conflicts and problems are amenable to other kinds of non-tragic solutions.
Now, Peter's point is a really essential one. You can't have tragedy if things are going to turn out all right, or can turn out all right, and that you can believe that either through faith in a transcendent religious solution to the conflicts and sufferings of our lives, or by believing in the possibilities of reason and science. I think it's important to ask ourselves how much we think we understand of the world around us, because even more important than the things that happen to us in tragic plays, I think, are the ignorances that are disclosed and discovered. Because in most classical tragedies, it is not an event, an action around which a play centers, but a discovery, a disclosure, and normally a disclosure of some tragic ignorance, some preceding ignorance. I think the important question is, which determines whether we can appreciate or believe in a tragic drama, is the question whether we think we understand enough or can understand enough to solve the problems of suffering and evil in our lives on our own. Some religious points of view lessen the sense of tragedy by believing that it will be canceled out in the end, either in this life or the next. The just will be rewarded and the unjust punished. And if things are going to work out that way, then it doesn't matter that we are so ignorant in our own lives, because we believe that our ignorance doesn't finally affect our ultimate happiness. But the modern rationalist confidence that we either do or can understand the essential conditions of our lives is just as inimical to a real tragedy, because you have to admit, to appreciate a tragedy, to see and believe in a tragic play, you have to be prepared to agree with the hero or the characters of the play that we do discover too late, often, crucial ignorances about the world around us. We do experience moments of awful sense of the pattern of things opening beneath our feet, and the confidence that we carry through daily life that we are in some kind of control of our lives is shaken for a moment. And in some paradoxical way, we feel strengthened by being able to face those moments when the pattern of things seems rent.
One of our examples this morning becomes Electra O'Neill, which was written when, in the 20s, I suppose?
30 or...
In the 30s. That, of course, is earlier than the flourishing of what we call the behavioral sciences. How is it that we can have tragedy, dramatic tragedy, literary tragedy, notions of tragedy in an age which is has been called fundamentally optimistic, reasonable in its outlook, in which we have the institutions that Peter Burian mentioned, which would, as you say, short-circuit that negativism, that final cry of despair. Do we indeed have tragedy, notions of tragedy today?
May I try to just briefly offer an answer in the form of stating what seems to me a problem in O'Neill's trilogy? What comes through, I think, out of 19th early 20th century rationalism in O'Neill is not so much the optimistic strain as it is the deterministic strain. That is, he uses a set of terms or relations that are largely really out of Freud, in a way that is meant to take the place of destiny in the traditional tragic discourse, but uses it in a way that is perhaps so mechanical in terms of the reproduction of distortions in relationships between the generations and so on, that there's really no room for action on the part of the characters. They're locked, they're bound by that apparently scientific determinism, that determinism which seems scientific to O'Neill in the 30s, into a set of struggles which is entirely predictable and whose outcome is, in a sense, a given right from the beginning.
And the difference, I take it, between this kind of tragedy and the tragedy that you talked about earlier, for instance, in Sophocles, Oedipus Rex, is that Oedipus brings upon himself the forces that disarrange his life, whereas the forces that you're describing, Peter, are there, and they don't need to be invited. You don't have to go looking for them in the form of a quest, looking for an answer to a question about your identity. Gene?
I'm not sure whether Oedipus disarranges his life. I think it is disarranged, and he has to face the consequences of the disarrangement.
Well, by asking the questions that he asks,
he is creating clarity, and that clarity is frightening. Uh-huh. But even at the risk of a terrible oversimplification, I would like to suggest, and this I think is shared by at least some people, that in a Sophoclean tragedy, whatever happens must happen. It couldn't be otherwise. The cards are stacked in such a way that one really cannot assume the question justifiably, oh, if only. If only such and such a thing hadn't occurred. The question that is thereby suggested is senseless. The fact is, this is how it had to be. And in the bourgeois tragedy, one could always say, well, it did happen that way, but it was inevitable. Whereas in antiquity, it is inevitable. It is inevitable by virtue of the situation, and it is inevitable by virtue of what I would translate as the, quote, inclination of the characters. Their spiritual and individual makeup. These are people who are really cast in such a way that you have to recognize they would not be what they are if they were dependent on external forces. They are making themselves. They are people who define themselves by virtue of basic inclinations. Now, in many a bourgeois tragedy, you could very frequently say, oh, well, this could have been remedied. This situation was not inevitable.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the third part in a series of conversations about notions of the tragic in Western literature. The panelists are Robert Terhorst, Peter Burian, Eugene Falk, and Peter Smith. Robert Terhorst is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, on leave from the University of Arizona, where he teaches Romance languages and literature. Peter Burian is a professor of classics at Duke University. Eugene Falk and Peter Smith teach at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professor Falk in the Department of Comparative Literature, Professor Smith in the Department of Classics. Here is Robert Terhorst.
I would like to try to put O'Neill a little bit more in his context. I think one thing we need to remember about American literature as distinct from American society is that American literature tends to be markedly pessimistic in contrast to the traditional notion that American society is optimistic. I'm not awfully convinced of that myself, but if one accepts that notion, one has to see that American literature does not normally take the view of society at large. And two, it seems to me that when Peter Burian was talking about determinism, he was talking about a literary mode called naturalism, which we find very much to characterize, above all, the American novel of the turn of the century, coming out of the French novel, particularly of Zola. And here, of course, one does see a determinism, a social determinism. I'm thinking now of Zola's L'Assommoir, where society simply crushes the protagonist of that very great novel, and which I would certainly call a tragic novel. But it does present a new notion of tragedy, where progress itself is tragic. This kind of literary phenomenon, I think, is very congenial to the dramatic genius and spirit of O'Neill. So we do find then a naturalistic literary mode in the drama of O'Neill, but I think it fits in very well with the tragic, but it is another notion of the tragic as socially determined.
Listening to Bob Terhorst's interesting distinction between the optimism of American ideology and the pessimism of American literature, it occurred to me perhaps one could locate the tragic conflict in a play whose status as tragedy has been the subject of very lively debate, Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller, in terms of the conflict between ideology and reality in American life. And here is a tragic hero who has, in a sense, swallowed the American ideology whole. He really believes that if he works hard enough, long enough, makes the right kinds of gestures, takes the right attitudes, learns the right social graces, that he can succeed, that he can become the true child of this American dream and what it has to offer. And what we see is the shattering of that illusion against the background of social realities, but also against the background of personal inadequacies.
What do literary people mean when they use terms like tragic vision? What are the ingredients?
For me, one thing is the horror. I suppose non-intellectual confrontation, but a confrontation with horror is one, for me personally, major occurrence or event in tragedy, that what you had expected to be one way, which something you'd expected to be benign, turns out to be destructive. Think of the family, the marital relationship of the Macbeths. That is a murderous relationship between husband and wife, and to discover there's a hideous discovery for Macbeth, in that he discovers in his wife a resolute, a magnificent murderess. This kind of discovery here again is a relationship which we normally assume to be nurturing and protective. To a degree, you find it also in a play which I don't know whether you would classify as a tragedy, but Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It explores the hideousness of marriage. I wonder if it couldn't, from that point of view, be considered a tragedy.
Peter?
One way of trying to define the tragic vision would be to talk about a conflict where real incompatible values are at stake. Hegel, for example, really developed his view of tragedy largely by looking very closely at Sophocles' Antigone, where he felt Creon embodied the rights of the state to create a certain kind of atmosphere through its laws in which its values would be fostered. And Antigone embodied values of religion and the family, which turn out in this case to be incompatible with Creon's state decree. That would be, one can raise lots of objections to that line of interpretation for the Antigone, but it certainly suggests, I think very fruitfully, the way in which competing real values, that is, things which we can argue that we need in order to live in the world, can meet head on, and where it's not easy to see how there can be a resolution between them. One or the other has to give way.
May I just add a footnote to what Peter Burian was saying? That in that play and in others, one of the ingredients is that the character or the hero must want to act. That so-called disposition toward action is a conditio sine qua non for the conflict to come about. The second point that emerges is that you couldn't blame either party. Both are right. Both are right, and their job is to prove that they are right. And that nobody could ever ask who is, quote, at fault. So that the resolution is a necessary destruction, not something that could be avoided. And as a result, we come out with the recognition, well, it couldn't have been different. It had to be that way. And we are reconciled. Not consoled, we are reconciled. In a Christian play, we may be also consoled. And one more point, which I think ought to be made in this connection. And that is that the values which are represented in great tragedy, if we are capable to distantiate ourselves sufficiently and forget that it is, quote, Antigone or Creon, but that Antigone and Creon are seen, that we see the universal in the particular, then that play will appeal and be understood, its values will be understood, always.
May I ask Bob a question to focus on just that point? It strikes me that in Calderon's play, the Doctor of His Own Honor, Don Gutierre acts in some ways like Othello, and he believes himself wrongly to have been betrayed by his wife, and kills her as a result. In the play, much of the language and much of the self-conscious thinking of the character centers on honor, her honor, his honor, the king and his brother's honor, more so than in Othello, but is not the underlying armature of conflict and misunderstanding the same?
I'm not sure. In the Calderon play, as I think in many tragedies, this question of value becomes fairly specific. What is the measure? Value can only be established by some measure, by some standard of value. Value comes from comparison. It seems to me that in tragedy, and in a tragedy like The Surgeon of His Honor, the standard of value is life, to live, to continue to exist. And I think tragedies, and I know that this Calderón tragedy plays with values that are seen as greater than life. Honor would be this a value of this category. An ordinary person, a servant, would consider existence as a supreme value and would do everything to preserve it. Nobles have a different understanding of life and of honor, and they see honor as more important than life, so that life can be sacrificed, murder can be committed to preserve it. So in that sense, I would see Calderón's play as attaching to many of the, I believe that addresses Jean Falk's question, that it, that's why murder becomes so important in many tragedies, because the murder is sacrificial. It's often committed to preserve something of higher value. Now, a disturbing problem, then, if Don Gutierre has a mistaken notion of the value of honor, then we get into a very complex situation here, where we see him, where we see Gutierre as a cruel tyrant, as a murderous despot who does his innocent wife in order to preserve something which is the value. And here again, I think this is Jean's point: a value in which we cannot all share. I would get around that. I don't know if I would answer that problem, but I would say that Calderón here is presenting an inevitability, and also a kind of degraded tragedy as degradation. Gutierre has a degraded notion of where true value is, and so he does not take action which would enable him to avoid murdering his wife, but so arranges his above all metaphorical thinking that he is compelled then to commit this sacrificial act, which is really an act, which is really a homicide or a suicide, which is really an act directed against himself.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the third segment in a series of conversations about notions of the tragic in Western literature. The panelists were Eugene Falk and Peter Smith of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona, and Peter Burian of Duke University. Professors Falk and Terhorst are scholars at the National Humanities Center. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.